Ron Paul Remains Unstoppable by yours truly, Jeff Deist. When Dr. Ron Paul suffered a health scare during his live Liberty Report show last Friday, I was perhaps less worried than most. His remarkable vitality, vigor, and energy are well known to those around him, along with his penchant for exercise and clean living and, of course, light eating. So having known him 30 years, I simply had no recollection of him ever being sick or out of commission. This is a man who had never missed a day of work or an event, at least in my memory. In my mind, he was simply always there, a fixture of life. So my immediate reaction was to think he would be fine. And as it turns out, he is fine, even unstoppable, you might say. So a bit of history. In Dr. Paul's congressional office during the early 2000s, his mostly Generation X staff, including myself, used to joke about how Ron would bury us all someday despite being several decades older. Now that we're in our 50s, that joke hits a bit closer to home. But we were all familiar with his relentless nature. His pace was legendary, waking early, printing articles to read, gathering newspapers, putting together his busy schedule for the day, and preparing for votes. It was always tough to keep up with him, literally, legging around Capitol Hill to hearings, media hits, or finalizing details for one of his infamous special order speeches at the end of the congressional day. Ron actually bid for our particular office in the Cannon House office building primarily for its proximity to the Capitol itself, so he'd spend the least amount of time commuting over to votes. When he needed double knee replacement surgery, there was no question about doing both the same day over the congressional Christmas break. Always true to form, he was up and about almost immediately and eschewed even over-the-counter pain medication. He was always moving and absolutely hated to wait. His years as a busy obstetrician with babies arriving at all hours of the night in far-flung rural Texas hospitals certainly served him well when it came to the less serious job of Congress, with its late-night votes and sudden schedule changes. Unlike medicine, however, the work of Congress is defined by motion rather than action. And unlike many of his colleagues, when the votes ended, Ron headed back to his nondescript condominium in Alexandria. There were no D.C. steakhouse dinners with lobbyists, no Capitol Hill bars and nightlife, and certainly none of the fleshy graft which ensnared so many Pauls over the years. Dr. Paul's energy spills over into his life at home, where he's always busy walking, biking, swimming, tending to his prized tomatoes, and hosting a steady stream of family and guests. His retirement, quote-unquote, from Congress at the end of 2012 finds him producing 5 live Liberty Report episodes every week with his co-host Daniel McAdams, along with writing, public speaking, and media appearances. But he's much happier these days without the dreadful weekly slog back and forth to Bush Intercontinental Airport on the far side of Houston, along with the infuriating Kabuki Theater known as TSA. His family life is no doubt much improved. Speaking of family, Ron and his wife Carol stand atop a pyramid of children. 5 children, with 3 of them MDs, 19 grandchildren, and 10, and counting, great-grandchildren. The Pauls have been married 63 years. Their children have been married a combined 167 years. Family, more than anything he has done in medicine or politics, will be Dr. Paul's lasting legacy. But there are lots of nights and weekends away from that family over the years, starting all the way back in the 1970s. So a bit more history is in order. Today happens to be the birthday of Ludwig von Mises, who played a brief but important role in the Ron Paul story. Nixon cut off gold convertibility by foreign central banks in 1971, and the alarmed young obstetrician began reading everything he could on money and inflation, including Mises, of course. A year later, Dr. Paul managed to get away from his busy medical practice for a day to hear the great man speak at the nearby University of Houston. And it's a good thing he did. Mises would die less than a year later. The talk Mises delivered that day, titled Why Socialism Always Fails, made a deep impression on Ron. He knew he had to do something. That something took the form of his decision to run for Congress in 1974. And in a very real sense, Dr. Paul is the only Misesian ever to serve in Congress. His first stint in the U.S. House only deepened his concerns about the monetary system. And in 1984, he took the gambit of giving up his seat to run against Phil Gramm for U.S. Senate. Graham prevailed, but Ron returned home to his medical practice, determined to remain active. He became involved in the precious metals community, began building contacts, and ultimately became the Libertarian Party candidate for president in 1988. Now, those involved with that presidential campaign, including Lou Rockwell, and my great friend, the late Kent Snyder, can tell you is no luxurious affair. With no internet, mobile phones, email, or social media, campaign events were hit or miss at best. Local newsletters and bulletin boards were the only source of information, and media appearances were distinctly earned in those days. Often a supporter in a beat-up car was the only campaign contact in any city, hopefully there to meet Ron after another cheap Southwest flight. Small groups of 20 or 30 people would gather at someone's home or a local diner, hear Ron speak, and pass the hat for travel funds. It was the shoestring of a campaign and hardly energizing or optimistic. But Ron persevered, knowing his efforts would bear fruit someday. So the famous Ron Paul of 2012 that many of you know, who spoke to 5,000 students at Berkeley, raised $30 million in his campaign, and appeared at all the CNN debates, first spent years away from his family and his medical practice building up his reputation. His return to the House of Representatives in the 1990s was both helped and hindered by his identification as a libertarian. His extensive contacts and earlier time in Congress gave him a fundraising base and name recognition, but also earned him the ire of the GOP. Upon informing Republican leaders of his intention to run for Congress again and suggesting he could win the South Texas seat from a sitting Democrat, the party swung into action against him. His by then well-known anti-war and anti-Fed views alarmed them, and his departure from the party in 1988 had angered them. So Newt Gingrich, the powerful Speaker of the House, convinced that Democrat, Greg Laughlin, to switch parties by promising him a seat on the powerful Ways and Means Committee. Dr. Paul thus found himself in a primary race against a sitting congressman he intended to face in the general election. But Ron knew the district and campaigned effectively against the outsiders trying to dictate who would hold the seat, especially Newt Gingrich, who blundered by flying to Texas for a Laughlin event. Meanwhile, then-Governor George W. Bush and his chief of staff, Karl Rove, were working behind the scenes to help Laughlin as well, but to no avail. When Ron won the primary, they called him over to the State House in Austin to offer both their surprise and their congratulations. His Democratic opponent in the general election, a trial lawyer named Charles Lefty Morris, attempted to paint Ron's opposition to the drug war as irresponsible and crazy. But Ron's campaign responded with an ad showing the mild-mannered doctor in his medical coat, the down-to-earth, trusted physician who had delivered thousands of babies across the congressional district. His personal reputation for sobriety as a family man deeply involved in his community blunted the political hits, which is, of course, an important lesson in itself. But even winning the general election in 1996 did not endear the GOP to Dr. Paul. Congressional leaders took the almost unprecedented step of disregarding his earlier time in Congress for purposes of seniority. Undaunted, Ron requested and received a seat on the banking committee, considered a boring backwater. Little did they know the Enron scandal and the Arthur Andersen collapse a few years later would make the newly christened Financial Services Committee one of the most powerful and sought after. Why? Remember the Sarbanes-Oxley bill regulating public companies and all the lobbying surrounding it? Imagine the post-congressional career riches. And little did they know that the Greenspan-Bernanke economy would implode about a decade later, making monetary policy a hot issue and presenting Dr. Paul with numerous chances to grill both men at committee hearings. Ultimately, he was awarded his delayed but rightful chairmanship of an important monetary policy subcommittee in 2010. Not surprisingly, Ron immediately turned the opportunity into a teachable moment, inviting Austrian economists as witnesses and luncheon speakers, and creating a truly intellectual atmosphere for interested members and staffers who had started to question the status quo. It was a brief but glorious time when Mises finally had a voice in Congress. Dr. Paul's other committee, Foreign Affairs, dovetailed perfectly with his warnings about monetary policy. Ron was able to make the connection between central banking and war finance, and also pressed Congress for a full-fledged declaration of war before invading Iraq in 2003. Here he built a foundation for a crossover anti-war coalition and gave his most impassioned arguments against war, the ultimate form of expansionary state power. It was here he opposed American quagmires in the Middle East, setting the stage for his 2008 and 2012 campaigns. And it was in the Foreign Affairs Committee that he cemented his reputation as the greatest peace advocate in Congress for decades. Despite his troubles with congressional leaders, Dr. Paul had many personal friends in Congress. He was well-liked and respected. His great friend, the late Walter Jones, stands out as someone who took Ron's anti-war message to heart and changed his position. Jones's district contained the huge army base Fort Bragg, and in part due to Ron's influence, he came out strongly against the war in Iraq. He attended many military funerals and comforted many spouses, in some parts thanks to the humility he saw in Ron. The great Jimmy Duncan of Tennessee was also a close friend, talking to Ron about reading antiwar.com articles by Justin Raimondo in his distinct Southern drawl. Spencer Baucus of Alabama, who became chair of the Financial Services Committee during the crash of 07, told the entire House Republican caucus that Ron Paul was right in his predictions of housing and equity bubbles. Barney Frank of Massachusetts was always cordial and ready to collaborate, as was the great peace advocate Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. The outpouring of love and affection shown to Dr. Paul last week after his incident shows the degree to which his revolution lives on. Ideas matter, but they are worthless without good people to advance and personify them. Dr. Paul is loved because he is genuine, a quality in short supply today, a quality which cannot be borrowed, bought, summoned, or faked. It's a quality our dangerously politicized country needs in spades. Ron Paul seems unstoppable, but of course no one is. He gave us and continues to give us a genuine alternative vision for a non-political world. But who will take his place?
For more content like this, visit Mises.org.